Good. Thank you for your attentiveness. This morning, members, the first thing on the agenda is we are going to hear from folks interested in the biozone and representatives from Minneapolis, Rochester, St. Paul here to give us some information. So, Representative Broad, we're gonna hear from you first?
Sure.
Okay. Excuse me, members. We're going to have Representative... Yes, we have to.
Okay.
Representative Broad is going to give us an outline of her legislation, which gives a tax credit. And then, members, we're not going to vote on this bill because my understanding is that the Commerce Committee wants to hear it first. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We do have somewhat before you House File 1127. This House File is essentially a vehicle for a discussion on an issue that's very important to the state of Minnesota and to areas throughout the state. Essentially, House File 1127 authorizes $2 million in tax incentives for biozones and biotechnology, and these zones are currently located in Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. I think today what we're really going to do is provide an overview of biosciences and how it's impacting Minnesota and how it's expected to impact these areas of the state. Lynn Osterman will be kind of coordinating this discussion. She's with Gray, Plant, and Moody now. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Lynn to walk through this process with you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you on behalf of a coalition for the opportunity to be before your committee this morning. As Representative Broad said, this is an informational opportunity.
Former Representative, you want to give us your name for the record?
Sure.
You know how that stuff works.
I already forgot. I'm sorry. I'm Lynn Osterman, for the record, and I am with Gray, Plant, Moody.
Can I start now?
Go
ahead.
All right. The first thing that we're going to do for you members is give you an overview of bioscience, what it is, why we think it's important that you learn more about it this week. This is one of nine hearings that have been scheduled by a number of people. Yesterday we met with Senate members in the Ag Committee, and we were with the Higher Education Committee here in the House. And today we've got two more hearings in similar settings, and so we appreciate the time to be with you today. So to start with, we're going to have a tape that will be about 10 minutes long to give a general overview, and then you'll hear from the zone community representatives, as Representative Broad indicated. And then to wrap it up, we've got an example of an incubator, a bioscience incubator in St. Paul, the University Enterprise Lab. So I'll just start the tape. Thanks.
A coalition of bioscience partners has worked together to organize hearings in various legislative committees. Thank you for your attention to this topic, and we look forward to continued discussion in the coming weeks of this session and beyond.
Too good to be able to see it, wasn't it? Okay, where's the magic guy?
I'll try to work it out.
Okay. Shutting
off transistor radios at the advent of the information economy. During the next 10 years, molecular technology will follow the same pattern as computer and information technology did, moving from the lab and into the basic operation of the world as we know it. But we're getting ahead of ourselves already. What is biotechnology anyway? And why should the Minnesota legislature care about public policy to support this industry? For 50 years, the developmental curve for the molecular economy has lagged behind the curve of the information economy. In the 1930s, we had magnification powers to view bacteria, but by the 1990s, that power of magnification had increased so we can see the scale of a single atom. Biotechnology is the use of information technology and biological techniques to solve problems, form new products, research opportunities for therapies, and apply discoveries to enhance existing products. A recent report by the Battelle Memorial Institute expands the definition from biotechnology to biosciences, capturing the application of chemistry, physics, and biology. There are five universally accepted categories, if you will, commonly referred to as bioscience: ag biotech and related bioproducts, drugs and pharmaceuticals, medical devices and instruments, hospitals and laboratories, and research and testing. According to the Battelle Institute study, over 800,000 people are employed in the bioscience industry nationwide. The device sector represents 37% of the industry of today overall, a distinct advantage for Minnesota, home to internationally recognized Medtronic, Boston Scientific, Guidant, and St. Jude, and a host of other companies that work closely with these major device organizations. Why is there so much focus on bioscience? 49 states, according to BIO, the National Trade Association, are formulating and implementing economic development strategies to support the growth of this relatively infant stage industry. Rapid growth is projected in the next 10 years, and the resulting high-wage, quality jobs will be diverse in research as well as manufacturing. Today's wages, industry-wide, average out to $63,000 per year, compared to manufacturing technology jobs alone, averaging $45,000 annually. How does this affect Minnesotans? Stop and consider for a moment. Chances are, some part of your life has been made better already because of bioscience. Human insulin, a biotech drug, was commercialized only as recently as 1982, and in 1987, the first biotech vaccine for hepatitis B. Those are but two examples of how new this industry is, only 20 years old. This is an infant stage industry. The CEO of Genentech, one of the largest biotech companies in the world, has commented that, at best, we may be barely approaching the threshold of the doorway as we enter into the bioscience field. The biggest focus of the bioscience industry is on improving individuals' health, and cancer is the number one target, whether it's to cure it outright or to make people more comfortable while receiving cancer treatment. The University of Minnesota and Hormel have the Hormel Institute in Austin, Minnesota, studying how foods we eat aid us to prevent and or treat cancer. And MGI Pharma, a locally grown company in Bloomington, makes an injectable drug, Aloxi, one of the most effective anti-nausea and anti-vomiting drugs on the market for patients undergoing chemotherapy. Again, human health improvement is a major focus of the industry. Many, many new biomedicines have been introduced. Biotechnology is the source of two-thirds of new medicines, and major pharmaceutical companies are purchasing small biotech research operations. The big companies want the products, and the small companies don't have the financial capacity to get the drugs to market. So companies are working together to accomplish their goals. Let's hear now from a major Minnesota human health bioscience initiative that we hope you're becoming familiar with.
Hello, I'd like to tell you about the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. What is genomics? Well, it's the study of genes. You may remember that the complete human genome was mapped just a few years ago. Medical genomics applies what we now know of our own genome, along with the latest technology to diagnose and treat patients. You may not know that doctors are already using medical genomics to personalize medicine, to decide the right dosage for each patient, to find increased genetic risks for certain diseases, and to create simple blood tests to screen for unseen genetic conditions. Minnesota has a special advantage in this area. Both Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota have strong foundations in medical genomics, with some research findings dating back nearly 20 years. While some states are just beginning to invest in this area, both of our institutions are already using medical genomics to help Minnesotans. For example, genomic-based testing for Tim Thomas from Bemidji revealed the cause of a potentially fatal heart condition, an inherited condition that had recently killed her mother at age 55. As a result of genomic testing, proper treatment has meant the prospect of a long and normal life for Kim and others in her family. Kim is just one of countless persons whose lives have been improved by genomics. For example, thousands of patient samples are being flown into Minnesota from around the world every day for genomic tests, tests that cannot be done where those patients live. The state of Minnesota is critical to the partnership's success, and I'm glad to report that with the state's support, this partnership has already accomplished quite a bit in a very short time. Within just 4 months of receiving $3 million in direct funding, the partnership has submitted 5 journal articles to publish its research findings. It has submitted 2 federal research grant applications. It's filed a patent application and opened a joint business office, as well as attract major philanthropic support. Yes, we've been busy, but that's because the time to move is now. The delay would slow the development of life-saving medical advances and could cost us our leadership role and millions in economic benefits. Now, when I say us, I don't mean just Mayo Clinic or the university. I mean Minnesota. All of us. Because this partnership is designed to benefit everyone in Minnesota. It's meant to deliver health benefits for citizens and economic benefits for the state's healthcare industry. And that increased revenue, of course, means new, high-quality jobs. The partnership also means an increase in intellectual property, licensed products and tests, and money coming in from out of state for these offerings. The partnership is already leveraging philanthropic support. There's also the potential for millions of dollars in federal grants that could be spent here in Minnesota. That money will be spent somewhere. Why not here? We also have a vision that extends beyond the borders of Minnesota. This partnership has the potential to make our state the national leader in medical genomics. Minnesota already has a reputation for medical advances and breakthroughs. We need to build on that foundation. But it's going to take a financial commitment up front. If we don't take this step, we'll lose this opportunity to other states, along with the revenue it will bring. And that is why action is needed now. The bioscience race is becoming increasingly competitive. States like Florida, California, New Jersey, North Carolina, even our neighbors in Wisconsin have recently committed huge amounts of money to this research. These efforts threaten to outpace Minnesota and lure away our scientists and physicians who are making these discoveries. Certainly other states are hoping that takes place. They're hoping that we take our time and lag behind so they can move ahead. We have a window of opportunity here, an opportunity to move forward and establish Minnesota as a leader in this revolutionary new field. I want to leave you with one last thought. You may have noticed that I've mentioned Minnesota quite often, and that this partnership is called the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. Well, it's because this is not specifically about Mayo Clinic or the university. It's about Minnesota. And that puts us in a unique position. Nowhere else is there a research partnership that involves an entire state. Not only is there potential for medical advances, economic rewards, and new jobs, but this would be the first time a whole state would be involved in creating cures. Our state, Minnesota. With your help, this is possible. And that's why we are asking for your support of the Minnesota Partnership for our body request and especially for our research funding.
Where else is the greatest potential for Minnesota's success? Minnesota is an international leader in the research, development, and manufacturing of medical devices. The additional opportunity is vast because of the convergence of biological applications and the devices, the drug-coated stent, for example. Traditional pharma, as in Johnson & Johnson, for instance, is partnering with Minnesota's own Guidant, using their devices as the delivery system for the drug products. Another unique opportunity for Minnesota to lead is in the area of agriculture and food bioscience, from animal and human health to farmers getting a better yield on their crops. It's also not just a matter of a better yield. Corn and soybeans, for instance, are grown with fewer chemicals because the plants themselves are less susceptible to disease or insects because of bioscience applications. Common products, such as plastic cups formerly 100% dependent on petroleum derivatives, can now be made from corn instead of petroleum, and detergent for removing stains from clothing use enzymes and contain fewer phosphates. With our combined assets in university and private sector research and our current corporate base, the emerging industrial bioscience sector is another unique opportunity for Minnesota. Imagine not having to depend on foreign oil or petroleum products. We can reduce our reliance and use biodiesel and bioethanol from soybeans and other crop oils. Crops can yield biodegradable greases and lubricants for our vehicles, and contaminants can be reduced or eliminated through bioremediation using microorganisms. The promise of biosciences is a benefit for all Minnesotans, with growing initiatives across the state, not just the Twin City metro area and Rochester. The employment opportunities for our citizens is tremendous, as is noted here in the percentage of various degrees applied in this industry in the state of Arizona today. Note that numerous positions are available for two-year degreed individuals, not just those with bachelor's or advanced degrees. Since the University of Minnesota is our academic research engine, we focus a great deal of attention there. But Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, MINSCU, will also play an integral role as we grow this industry. The laboratory space at MINSCU campuses is in need of enhancement now, so tomorrow's technical workers are well trained. Recognizing that one of the key components in maximizing our state's potential in this industry is a prepared workforce, please support MINSCU's request for investment in these science labs across the state.
Thank you for your attention. That was just a brief overview so that you're not under the impression that we're talking just about human health applications when we're talking about bioscience in Minnesota. The remainder of that tape deals with the topic that we're in today's hearing to discuss, however, and so that's why I stopped it, and that is to talk about the existing bioscience zone, the activity currently within those zones, and the potential, if you will allow us to expand what it is that we're able to do there. So in alphabetical order, we're going to hear from the three communities that are currently part of the bioscience zone here in Minnesota. So we'll start with Minneapolis, and I would ask Councilmember Paul Zerbe to come up and introduce his other guests. Thank you.
Chair Krenke.
Welcome to the committee. You want to give us again your name and your position for the tape?
Thank you. My name is Paul Zerbe. I'm on the Minneapolis City Council and have the areas that I represent. I'm honored to say include the University of Minnesota, the surrounding neighborhoods, and the Elliott Park Life Science Institute, so that I have a deep interest in what we're doing today. This is but it isn't just this ward, obviously. It is very high on the City of Minneapolis's priorities. And it's a rare opportunity for cooperation, which is taking place on a number of levels. The city has entered into a memorandum of understanding with the University of Minnesota, looking to develop a university research park running across the southeast Minneapolis industrial area from the Minneapolis campus all the way to the St. Paul border. We have also entered into, we had a kind of historic meeting of the joint intergovernmental relations committees of the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we are both put the biosciences zone very high on our priorities. So we are working together cooperatively there. And as the tape mentioned, this also brings in not only Rochester, but really all about state. So I feel very honored to be before you, Chair Krenke and members. I have with me Keith Schoquist, who is on my immediate right. Keith is an architect by trade. He is a member and former chair of the Southeast Business Association and is the current chair of the Southeast Economic Development Committee. That, in those capacities, he has worked cooperatively with all the neighborhood groups around and the University of Minnesota, really has been working on this for somewhere in the nature of 10 years to get this going, and we're excited because we think with your help we can do that. I turn it over to Keith.
My name is Keith Schoquist, and I'm here representing the Southeast Economic Development Committee. And as Paul mentioned, this has been a very cooperative effort. The four neighborhoods that have been involved in this whole process are Prospect Park, Marcy Homes, Como, and St. Anthony Park across the divide from St. Paul. And we also have two business associations, Southeast Business Association and Dinkytown. Now, we've been working in this area trying to encourage development of the whole former rail yards and milling area. There's about 700 acres totally in this area. It's a real prime area for development, but one of the big handicaps, of course, is its prior usage with a lot of environmental issues to be dealt with on the soils. But we have been working on that. We've completed a master plan for the area. We've completed an AUAR study, which deals with the drainage and the other infrastructure needs that are needed in the area. And that's the point of being here today, too, is to encourage the development of the infrastructure, which, of course, no development can take place without that. And so that's briefly. I know the time is short here, so I'll just be brief here and turn it over to James Theis. James is the president of Shepherd Medical Companies and Twin Star Medical, and these are two companies that have been involved with the business credits in the bioscience zone.
Twin Star and Shepherd, which I'm president, are both located in the Minneapolis Life Science Corridor. We're adjacent to the Hennepin County Medical Center. We were the first companies to get the business credits issued to us. And although we're small companies, less than just a few employees, we do have salaries over $40,000 to everybody. The amounts in the business credits were meaningful enough to retain us and keep us there near Hennepin County Medical Center. And based on my experience in about 20 years in the medical device industry, the location that we're at in the Minneapolis Life Science Corridor there is very appropriate for us. And overall, I think it's the business credit program is a meaningful program that we look forward to perhaps having the opportunity to participate in the future. Thank you.
Mr. Shepherd, correct?
Jim Theis.
I'm
of Shepherd
Theis.
Medical.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Got confused. Can you give us an indication of what your business does?
Yeah, the Twin Star Medical is involved in catheters, reduce swelling in trauma patients located next to Hennepin. They do a lot of trauma patients there. Brain swelling or swelling from tibia fractures. The other company, Shepherd Medical, which I'm part-time CEO, has a NIH grant to study the reversible vasectomy implant product.
Where's Representative Rukavina when you need him? Anyway. Okay. I appreciate very much your coming in. Again, we're going to move this along fairly quickly, gentlemen. So, again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having us.
Mr. Chair, our next speaker is John Eckerman, and John is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Rochester Area Chamber of Commerce.
Chairman Kroenke, committee members, my name is John Eckerman, Governmental Affairs Director of the Rochester Area Chamber of Commerce, representing our chamber and also the Rochester Economic Area Development Corporation. I'm here today on to advocate for changing it from $1 million to $2 million. The Rochester community is a leader in bioscience, biotechnology, and genomics. Companies such as Mayo Clinic, IBM, PEMSTAR, JDS Uniphase, just to name a few, are critical to the health of our state's economy. I hope you had a chance to tour the Mayo Clinic during the Governor Plenty's State of the State address last month. If you did, you learned about the potential of this great bioscience and genomics industry. As the video stated earlier, the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics is one of the keys. The combination of bonding dollars for the Mayo Clinic University of Minnesota Genomics Research Building, full funding for 5 years of operating funds for the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics, and increasing the bioscience zone cap is the synergy we need to grow this industry in our state. The partnership between Mayo and IBM is another key. The bioinformatics that IBM is developing is taking medical information, which took months and years to decipher, now can be done in a matter of minutes. With this investment, medical device and pharmaceutical companies will want to invest in our community because of skilled labor force and potential partner industries. I spoke with Gary Smith, who is the executive director of the Rochester Economic Development, and he informed me that a number of businesses have contacted him, but the $1 million cap currently is a problem and is a concern for them. We cannot wait a few years. We need to act now. You're not going to produce a cheaper widget than what China is doing now, but We can't compete in this bioscience industry. States such as Arizona, California, Ohio, and even our neighbors in Iowa and Wisconsin are investing billions in bioscience and genomics as we speak. We cannot wait too long or it'll be too far to catch up. To summarize, the biosciences will be one of the industries driving our nation's economy for the next 30 years. For our state to be on the front end of the curve, we need to act today. Supporting the raising of the cap from $1 billion to $2 million is one tool which will help Minnesota get into the bioscience race. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eckman. Can you give us an indication as to, as Minneapolis did, do you have a specific zone or do you have a specific area for these, where these businesses operations would locate?
Yeah, there's a zone around Rochester that the specifics I'm not privy to. There has been a number of companies that have made some inquiries.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Gene Goddard. I'm the Bioscience Industry Specialist for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I oversee the Bioscience Zone program for the department. With Minneapolis, the Bioscience Zone area is around the semi-industrial park area and then down Chicago Avenue from roughly Hennepin Community Center down towards the part of it, and then the other part goes down towards the Sears Tower on Chicago. In Rochester, it's all of downtown Rochester and then scattered properties on the western side around the community, as well as some properties around the university center in on the east side of downtown as well. Designed to facilitate the growth of companies outside near the Mayo Clinic as well as some of the other research facilities around the western edge of the community, including the IBM facility, the PEMSTAR facility, and some of the other Mayo facilities on the western side of the community. In St. Paul's Bioscience Zone, which we'll be speaking next, their area is from roughly Hubbard Broadcasting on the University and 280 along Energy Park Drive over to Lexington Avenue. Each community received approximately 500 acres.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions of the gentleman from Rochester? Okay. If not, thank you very much. Appreciate your being here today.
Mr. Chair, at this point we're going to hear from Tom Triplett. Tom Triplett is the Senior Policy Advisor to Mayor Kelly in St. Paul.
Mr. Chairman and members, it's my pleasure to be here this morning. I am Tom Triplett from Mayor Kelly's office. We're putting up on the wall the Minneapolis map that you have copies of. It's somewhat ironic that we're using the Minneapolis map to show you the St. Paul Bioscience Zone, but it's an indication of how our two cities are working together. You'll see the colored purple areas on the map in front of you. That's the Minneapolis side. That faint yellow vertical line, which is a few blocks west of Highway 280, that's the city border between Minneapolis and St. Paul. So our zone continues immediately east of the Minneapolis zone, continues across Highway 280. The cornerstone of St. Paul's zone is University Enterprise Laboratories that Lynn mentioned. And after I speak, Peter Bianco, who's the CEO of UEL, will talk a little bit more about it. But just so you get the geographic sense, if you look at Highway 280 and you see the green line running through the zero on 280, that's the dedicated transit way. That's that bus line that connects the two campuses of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the University of Minnesota. It's a critical transportation route. The UEL building is just south of the dedicated transitway and immediately west of Highway 280. That's where my pen is pointing now. That's UEL, and Pete will talk about that in a minute. So our first priority in St. Paul is the development of the Bioscience Park. We'll be building out from UEL, talking about adjoining properties, and we'll have more to report on that to you in a few months, but those discussions and negotiations are underway. The second piece of our initiative is the public infrastructure piece. In order to make the most effective use of these sites, we need better transportation mechanisms to join these sites together. The site right now is surrounded by University Avenue on the south. If the Central Corridor Light Rail proceeds, we'll be very close to that. The railroad tracks on the north could potentially become the Red Rock Corridor rail line into the future. And then you've got roadway improvement needs, which are needed to connect the Minneapolis and St. Paul sites. A week from today, Mr. Chairman and members, will be meeting with Minneapolis Public Works to begin those discussions to make sure that those roads, when they are built, do end up connecting together. And I should say, Mr. Chairman and members, that this is somewhat historic, where Minneapolis and St. Paul are working together, totally together, on a joint project of such mutual importance.
Mr. Triplett,
certainly is our finance...
Excuse me, 1 second. Could you just point out on the map, where's the DMZ here? it doesn't show on the map.
We're trying to eliminate that.
Okay.
It's a very good observation. Our third priority in bioscience is financial assistance, and that's one of the purposes of this bill, obviously, is to extend and that tax credit. Just for your information, 21 St. Paul-based bioscience companies or potential companies have expressed interest in the tax credit. Five of them have been committed already. So we're going to run out of that tax credit. We desperately have to have it continued and expanded, and that's what Representative Brill's bill is all about. And I should say, Mr. Chairman and members, that I just returned from a day and a half in Madison yesterday and visited their site, their park, which has now been in existence for 21 years. And what they've been able to accomplish in Madison, both geographically and industry-wise, is phenomenal. Madison's a much smaller town than the Twin Cities, but let me tell you, they are way ahead of us on a lot of these things. And so issues like the tax credit and financing infrastructure development is critical. And with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to introduce Peter Bianco, who is the CEO and president of University Enterprise Laboratories, which is the partnership between the university and the city of St. Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Bianco. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of University Enterprise Laboratories. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the progress of our particular facility at this time. We're located at 1000 Westgate Drive, as Tom mentioned, in the St. Paul Bioscience Zone. On January 21st, we secured $24 million in financing to secure the building, which is the former home of TargetDirect.com. And have begun construction on 21 wet labs and over 100,000 square feet of office space. We are scheduled to open the doors of our building in July-August of 2005, and currently, as of today, we have a commitment for 70% of the space, including 12 wet labs out of 21, which is a testimony to the pent-up demand required here. Now, University Enterprise Laboratories is a public-private partnership between the University of Minnesota, the City of St. Paul, and several major corporations, including Xcel Energy, Boston Scientific, Surmodics, Medtronic, Guidant, and Allina. When we open the doors in July, the clock will begin ticking with respect to our pipeline in assisting early-stage bioscience companies in achieving their goals of moving from basic research from the bench to the commercial marketplace. When they reach the door in 3 to 5 years, they will be ready to go to the next level and at that point are still highly portable and will follow wherever they need to go to access capital and infrastructure. This bill is very important to begin putting together the underpinnings of the capital infrastructure that will ensure that these companies stay here in Minnesota when they're ready to go to the next level. My concern previously has been that to access the venture capital required for these companies to grow before they put down roots in our community is available on either in San Francisco or in Boston, and it is not unlikely that some of these companies will have to move to either one of those communities to continue on their growth path. And now with the what's happening in Madison and the state of Wisconsin, I'm even more concerned that some of these companies will pick up and move to Madison. It's a very real danger. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Are there any questions, members? Mr. Bianco or the any other witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Broad, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been an easy bill for me to talk about here today, but this bill will be formally brought before the committee after I hope it skates through Representative Cole's Division of Biosciences from Commerce, and we'll be hopefully talking about specifics and any questions that you have about the zones and the use of the dollars that we're hoping to increase through this bill. We'd be happy to do that. But we do have a tremendous opportunity before us in Minnesota in regards to biosciences, and I'm very excited about the impact that it will have on our economy in general. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members. I very much appreciate it.
If there are no further questions or comments, thank you, Representative Broad. We will re-refer the bill to the Commerce Committee. Thank you very much. Next on the agenda, members, today is the House File 660. This is the governor's tax proposal. Members, we are going to hear from the department about the, they're going to give us an overview of the bill, and then we'll hopefully vote this out of here by noon today. So, with that, Commissioner, that was just to see if you're awake, folks.
Is that your motion, Mr. Chair?
I just, for those people who are kind of not paying attention, Representative Malblock, just wanted to see if we have everybody's attention. So, welcome, Commissioner. You think we're going to get the votes to pass this out today, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I haven't done a note. I haven't counted. Would be nice.
We'll tell the governor that it's all predicated on your presentation here. So.
Okay.
let's start then, Commissioner, with an overview of House File 660.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Solomone, Commissioner of Revenue. And with me here is John Haugen from our Appeals and Legal Division, who will walk us through the bill summary, and also Jack Manson, my Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy. If it's okay with the Chair, we'll proceed to walk through the bill summary and take your questions as we go along.
That'd be terrific.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Haugen from the Department of Revenue. I'll be doing the individual income tax and corporate franchise tax article and the federal update article 2, and then I'll be off the hook, hopefully. Section 1, Article 1, deals with partnership withholding. Currently, if you're a partnership or an S-corporation, you have non-resident partners, you're supposed to be paying in tax for these non-residents who have Minnesota assignable income. The current law is that these partnerships and S-corporations, they wait until the end of the year. When they file their return, they make the payment. Everybody else, when they're paying their Minnesota taxes, they have to make either quarterly estimated tax payments or there's withholding from their paychecks as you go along during the year. This provision would provide that partnerships and S-corporations where they're withholding for these non-resident partners, they'll be making quarterly payments just sort of similar to estimated tax payments. Section 2 deals with the definition of foreign operating corporations.
Excuse me, it would be helpful, I think, as we go through, if you could give us an indication as to what the fiscal impact is as well, just so members can kind of tie the language to the revenue analysis.
Mr. Chairman, Section 1 is a revenue shift. What it does is it moves two quarters of estimated tax payments up a quarter or up a fiscal year. So there's a $14.2 million shift that occurs where we get the money earlier than we would have normally. Then on an ongoing basis, since this area, there's always more and more people getting and investing in Minnesota, there is an increase for the shifts that for the more or less inflation as we go along. Section 2 deals with...
Excuse me, Mr. Haugen. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haugen, you know, it went real quick there. And I want to understand exactly who's going to pay it, be accelerated, why they're going to be accelerated. And we just had a 50-minute presentation about how we're trying to get businesses to move to Minnesota and to invest in Minnesota. And then 3 minutes later, the department's up saying, here's how we're going to get your money from you earlier. So could you first talk to me a little bit about how this is going to operate, how this is going to affect somebody's tax liability, who's going to pay, and why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, the way that currently, as I explained earlier, the way it currently works is you have a partnership. If they have non-resident, and that partnership is doing business in Minnesota, and they generate taxable income.
Uh-huh.
Under the current, if the individual partners were making estimated tax payments, they would be making quarterly estimated tax payments as they go through the tax year based on what they guess their partnership income is going to be that's assignable to Minnesota. We have a provision that we put in the, I think it was the late 90s, where or the early 90s, where the partnership itself is required to withhold for these non-resident partners that have Minnesota assignable partnership or S-corporation income. The way that the current law is structured, that withholding and their payment isn't really due until they file their return, which is after the tax year. This would accelerate it and put these partnerships, would make them put the money in on a quarterly basis as the tax year rolls on.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haugen, if I am a non-resident Minnesotan, it's the partnership that currently withholds, and that gets passed through on some disclosure, a statement to me, rather than I being required to make the estimated quarterly payments to Minnesota. Is that how it works, Mr. Haugen?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Our representative,
okay.
That is correct. So, you know, it's sort of like if in the situation where you're an employee, they're taking your money out every pay period, and the employer pays it in pretty much right away. Here, on the other hand, they're not paying us until 2.5 months after the end of the tax year. So we're getting the money later in this situation than we do for normal taxpayers.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haugen, how many other states have withholding at the partnership level for foreign partners? Because I know that I am a partner in a couple of partnerships that have their situs in another state, and I have to make quarterly payments to the other state, however meager they may be. But is this a unique provision of Minnesota law that the withholding is done at the partnership level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, back when it was first enacted, we were unique. I think we were the first state. Currently, I think there are a few.
Also, we did this, Mr. Haugen, when John Gunyu was finance commissioner. One of these gimmicks when John Gunyu was finance commissioner. Can we look that up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, back then it was not an acceleration, and it was basically a compliance issue, because what was happening is we would have these non-residents who would have Minnesota source income. They wouldn't file a return, they wouldn't pay us the tax, and it was very difficult to collect from them. With the partnership withholding, we got that money. We were actually going to get the money. Here, where we wanted, as you said, we want it earlier, just like we want it earlier from practically every other taxpayer that's paying Minnesota tax. We want it during the tax year.
Well, Mr. Haugen, putting aside the kind of the snide remark I made that I kind of regret now, but I saw Mr. Gunyu again on television last night, and he just immediately leaped to mind when I heard it was the early 90s. How many other states have a provision like this in which the partnership withholds rather than the individual making the estimated payments? How many other states do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, I'm not really sure whether it's a handful or whether it's 10, 20, I'm not really sure. I could research that and try to get back to you on that.
Well, I'd appreciate it because, Chairman, I have a great deal of respect for your work, Mr. Haugen, and for Commissioner Salamone and the people at the department. I won't stand in the back seat to anybody, but when I saw it on the spreadsheet, you know, when I heard the initial explanation in my office, when I heard the explanation today, I'm still a little baffled by the provision and why it's even in law to begin with. But I certainly can be convinced to the contrary, but it does seem like a really odd duck.
Mr. Haugen, if you think you had a hard time with me, you probably got a tougher time with me convincing me this is a good idea, because my question would go to, first of all, and I know we're going to probably have difficulty voting on this by noon if I keep asking these questions, but the situation I guess I'm familiar with is that obviously under S elections, the you have minority ownership in S corporation that may not there may not be any dividend payment until the end of the year. You have people who maybe don't have significant incomes or means. How would you expect that an individual under an S election where the distribution isn't made until the end of the fiscal year, in fact, I believe it can actually be made 90 days after the end of the fiscal year, how are they supposed to make those estimated payments?
Mr. Chairman, with the flow-through entity, it doesn't matter what they distribute. You're going to get taxed on the flow-through income whether you get the cash or not.
I'm cognizant of that, but that's what I'm saying.
In this situation, it's not the individual partner or shareholder who is giving us the money. It is the entity. It's the flow-through entity that is generating the net income. So we assume since they were generating net income that they would have some cash to make these estimated tax payments.
I think we need to take a stroll around Minnesota and talk to some S corporations who have a little difficulty making a profit in order to pay all these. But anyway, Representative Mullery, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Haugen, do S corporations have the same opportunity to not pay until, in other words, with regular estimates, if you're not making money in the first part of the year, you don't have to pay it at that point? Can you delay it for an S corporation or not in the same way? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulrich, they're only in the withholding aspect can they delay. With the S corporations, they have what's called a minimum fee. There, they have to pay that quarterly, just like anybody else. But with the non-resident withholding, or if they're filing a composite return for their non-resident shareholders, there they have to make the payments quarterly. It's only in this one situation where they're actually not doing the composite return that they're required to do the withholding, and then they can wait until the end of the year.
Mr. Haugen, just one additional question then. On the spreadsheet here, it shows the shift in 06, $14.2 million, and then we have an increasing amount of revenue. If this is a shift, why would we see increasing revenues in the out years?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that what that is that as historically the amount of revenue that we get from the non-resident withholding has been increasing year after year after year. It's always been growing. And that $90,000 that you're seeing there is those increases.
Okay. Thank you. Now as we speed along, we can go to the second section.
Section 2, foreign operating corporations. This is a change in the definition of what a foreign operating corporation is. Basically, what the main change is that under the old law, you could be a foreign operating corporation and not have any payroll or property. What this provision would require is that you have at least $1 million of payroll and $2 million of property that are located outside the United States. The old law was in terms of you you couldn't have more than 20% of your property and payroll in the United States. The situation that we had a court case on was that this foreign operating corporate company didn't have any payroll or property at all, which makes you kind of wonder how they could be an operating company if they didn't have any property or payroll. But that was the case, and they had zero property or payroll, so their percentage was zero, which was less than 20%. Here what we're doing is we're trying to make it so that they have to have a minimum amount of property and payroll to show that they're actually operating to get the foreign operating corporation treatment. Dollar amount for that one is $1.3 million the first year, about $980,000 the second, $650,000, and it's on a decreasing basis.
Cost. Increase.
Additional revenues, Representative. I'm sorry. Representative Lucheski has a question.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. The 80% part of this proposal from the governor, I agree with that. But to satisfy the foreign property at $1 million and the foreign payroll at $2 million, where does the department come up with that number? What, I'm just trying to think about which companies that's going to hurt and help. Why did you land on $1 million and $2 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lubchesky, I think I'll let Assistant Commissioner Manson answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And Representative Lubchesky, I don't think there's any magic number or any policy really associated with that. It's just kind of numbers that we did pick that we thought were kind of would be some substantial operations over in those foreign countries.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Consider the following hypothetical. I am a large company, and I have operations throughout the world. And for a variety of reasons, I'm going to want to lease or even enter into partnerships to buy property to sustain my operations. And in order to do so, I want to have a separate entity to manage it and to manage getting into the partnerships. So I may only have one or two people on the payroll negotiating these deals, but the company could have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property, but basically only one or two people on the holding company's payroll of a foreign operating company. Why is the payroll number so important if you meet a property threshold? And aren't you basically saying that if with $1 million threshold that you're going to be moving jobs out of the state in order to be able to meet $1 million? Otherwise, I want the job because then I can get paid $1 million in order to fall under the safe harbor. How would that hypothetical work under this construct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abrams, I think we looked at it as, to be an operating company, you'd have to have both property and employees. And even under the original statute, it also talked about both property and payrolls, but to the extent it had to be 80%, or less than 20% in the United States. The government proposal last year, I think, had either or, so which would address your particular hypothetical. It's definitely something that's negotiable, but we just thought that an operating company should have both property and payroll. And we also did add this year that if you do have partnerships of property and payroll, that does factor into meeting those thresholds.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the whole reason for the foreign operating company is simply to hold property in order to sustain your manufacturing operations. You may have a different partnership in Germany than you do in Argentina, than you do in Singapore, than you do in Japan, but you want the one entity for a whole variety of good tax planning reasons to be the holding company, and you may only have two or three people assigned to operate the affairs of this company. And what's going on the property is you're having your subsidiaries operate on the real estate or on the buildings that you're holding in this way. So what I'm setting up is not a sham, as was the case in the Hutchinson Technology case, although I shouldn't call it that because it's on appeal. But
discount that.
But a real operating real estate holding entity to sustain the operations of a Minnesota-based company. And I understand that we want to get at the scoff laws, but there are some substantial business reasons to construct the holding company in this way, and basically what you're saying is you either move payroll out or you have to go to a different construction. If you need a different construction, I'll be very happy to show you a different construction that can get around this. You know, I'm interested in something that's going to work and not something that's going to be feel good, and I'm really worried that by saying $1 million and $2 million that it might feel good, but you're going to be basically creating work for legal departments for some of the largest Minnesota companies that are not operating FOCs as shams. So, you know, I hope that you think about that construct a little bit, because I just see it as a feel good and not really very substantive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, I'd just like to point out also that we have also included contract labor. So if you don't have actual employees, the contract labor would qualify. You would not have to meet the payroll threshold under this proposal.
Mr. Chairman, the whole construct is all you have is a real estate holding company in order to have an entity hold all of your real estate interests, which are going to probably be interests and partnerships that are going to be different in place. There is going to be no contract labor. All you basically have is somebody negotiating the contracts, and then it's a net lease. And probably in a couple of these countries, there's probably four or five other nets put into it. But there would be virtually no payroll, and that concerns me.
Do you want to take another crack at that, Mr. Benson?
I think Commissioner Salamone knows exactly what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I think the issue is, I mean, I think Jack was right to say there's some room to sort of negotiate these details, but we're trying to get at some assurance that we're talking about a real operating company in those foreign countries. So to the extent that they're operating, I mean, that's the goal. Mm-hmm. How we get there is maybe still open for some discussion.
Okay. We're going to have real difficulty getting through this here in the next 35 minutes. But anyway,
can I skip a few sections?
Let's move rapidly on to Section 3.
Section 3 is a new credit for dairy farmers. It's a 10% credit that you can get for purchases of equipment that you use in a dairy operation that you purchased between 2007 and the end of 2011. It's 10% of whatever you purchase for the dairy farm other than the herd itself and land, which you can't depreciate. The maximum that a taxpayer can get is $30,000 over the six years. The cap applies at the individual level, the flow-through level, and the corporate level. That's more or less to limit the amount that this will cost the state. The cost to the state would be about $3 million a year, mm-hmm, starting in 07. The credit is non-refundable. If your credit exceeds your tax, you can carry over the remaining credit for 15 years until you use it up. Sections 4 and 5 deal with the long-term health insurance credit. This proposal would make a slight modification in the calculation of the long-term health insurance credit that you can get for purchasing long-term health insurance. The current one has the provision that if you
are itemizing deductions, and you're deducting those premiums as an itemized deduction. You can't use those deductions to the extent that you got a federal tax benefit from them. You can't use those to qualify for the long-term health insurance credit. To simplify things and to give people more of a credit, we are going to, this proposal would say that even though you're deducting them and getting a federal tax benefit for the deduction for the premiums, you can still use those amounts to qualify for the credit. Section 6 and 7, and on this one there is an amendment that I think that you have in your packets. So I'll try to hit that towards the end of 6 and 7. Currently, Minnesota's three-factor apportionment schedule is 75% factor sales factor. What this proposal would do, with starting in 2007, for the next 7 years, that 75% would be going up by 3% each year until the eighth year when it goes up to 4%, and then we'd have 100% sales factor. Section 6 is for most businesses. Section 7 is for financial institutions. The amendment that you have is a clarification that for the occupation tax, we are going to remain at the 75, 12 and a half, 12 and a half. Oh, and the cost of that one is $1.8 million in 07, $7.6 million in 08, $15.2 million in 09, and I assume that it would keep on getting bigger and bigger as we go out. Section 8 is a withholding tax provision for independent contractors performing construction work in Minnesota. This would require that if you're in a trade or business and you're having construction work done by an independent contractor that is an individual as opposed to a corporation or a partnership or something like that, you will be required to withhold and remit to the department 2% of whatever you're going to be paying that independent contractor, to the extent that you're paying that independent contractor more than $600 in a calendar year. Article 2.
Can you just, I'm sorry, let's just the section 8 here, withholding. Want to give us an indication as to how you anticipate this would work?
Mr. Chairman, the way that we envision a better work is currently if you're in a trade or business and you hire an independent contractor and you pay them more than $600 in a calendar year for whatever work, you have to issue them a 1099 at the end of the year. So there is filing requirements for this type of information already. What we're saying in this is that if you're required to issue that person a 1099, before you pay them the more than $600 that you're going to pay them, you will hold back 2% and remit that to the Department of Revenue as withholding for that that independent contractor. He would then, in effect, get a 1099 at the end of the year that would show that there was X amount of Minnesota withholding that he would then take as a credit on his individual income tax return.
And how much are we compensating the businesses around the state of Minnesota to do this for you?
Mr. Chairman, as much as we do when they withhold for an employee.
Thank you. Representative Simpson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this pertain to an individual? I'm building a house, and I'm hiring trades to do it. I'm hiring independent contractors. How would that relate to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, in your situation where you're having your personal residence built, since you aren't engaged in it, you aren't hiring the person in conjunction with your trade or business, there would be no requirement that you withhold for that person. And there also isn't any requirement that you give them a 1099 at the end of the year either. But on the other hand, if you were more or less, let's say that you were you were going to put in a commercial garage, and you were hiring for that purpose, that's part of your trade or business, then you would have to do this withholding.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Westberg.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My question would be along that same line then. If the building contractor makes a mistake and doesn't, collect the 2% additional, at the end of the year and then issues the 1099, are there any fines or penalties against the contractor for failure to do so?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westerberg, they would be subject to the same penalties that an employer would be subject to if they did not withhold for an employee. So there could be, in a case where they didn't file a withholding tax return, I think what the penalties are 5% for late file and 6% for late pay. If they filed a return and didn't include this withholding on there, then there might not, there, other than interest, there might not be any penalty at all.
Mr. Hogg, I'm getting closer to voting no. Anyway, I'm sorry, the can you just, I don't see a, this is obviously a shift. Or is there a compliance issue? I don't see any number in the
Mr.
spreadsheet
Chairman,
for it.
There would not be any number on this because, in theory, the worker would more or less be required to make estimated tax payments quarterly during the year. So we'd be getting the money somewhat at the same time as we might be getting it a little bit sooner, but there wouldn't be much of a shift.
Mr. Chairman.
So, I'm sorry, so this is a compliance issue? I mean, that's what we're trying to...
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. What we're seeing now is you see a lot of roofers, you see a lot of landscaping and things like that, where everybody that works on the landscaping is an independent contractor.
We're getting close, Bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Close it in
on you. As I said, just because the author votes go to, doesn't mean the rest of the committee members have to... Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many states do this now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, I'm not sure. I would doubt that many do. There are some.
So we would
Quanta North, North Star.
We would be at the forefront of harassment of so then how do you know again how would the general or the contractor know again which subs he had to do that to? He had to provide this withholding for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator...
It's Representative.
Representative, excuse me. The way that it would work is the worker is going to have to give, or the contractor is going to have to give a federal identification number. In the case where it's an individual, it's going to be a Social Security number. In the case of partnership or an S corporation or a corporation, it's going to be a 401 number, federal ID, business ID number. So if you're getting a Social Security number from the worker, you should be withholding.
So, Mr. Chair, then every contractor that does work for a business would have to be withheld for payments over $600, you'd have to withhold 2%. So would this be like FedEx and UPS in our case, or how are you defining who the business has to withhold on?
Mr. Howden.
Mr. Chairman, are you talking about who does the withholding?
Well, it says requires businesses to hire hire individual independent contractors to perform construction work in Minnesota to withhold and remit. So that means everyone that I hired as a business to, if I hired a Harman Glass to come and put in some windows, am I going to have to withhold 2% on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, are you talking about your personal residence or are you talking about your trade or business?
If I own a building and I have Harman Glass come and put some windows in it, and I'm a licensed contractor, do I have to withhold 2% from Harman Glass?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you're the general contractor and you're hiring subs,
yes,
to do the work, and the sub is an individual who says that he's an independent contractor and actually is, then you would have to withhold for that sub. If you paid that subcontract.
And whose idea was this again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this came out of the withholding in the individual income tax division.
So, Mr. Chair, all the businesses would become a revenue department collecting taxes for the state. That's a nice handoff.
You already are, Representative.
Well, that's true. That's
just expanding your authority.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify that there is a revenue impact associated with this proposal, and it's $2 million a year, and it's some compliance dollars similar to other compliance initiatives we've brought forward before. And our study did show that approximately 2,000 non-resident contractors underreported income of upwards of $85 million. So this is a substantial compliance issue for the department, and that's why the department has brought it forward.
Mr. Manson, is it, as I said, is it in the revenue analysis? Or are you saying it's...
Chairman, it's being carried in the State Department's bill.
What?
Oh.
Chairman? Chairman?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. I see Commissioner Salamone. Commissioner, why is this being carried in the state government finance bill and not in the tax bill? What is the reason?
Mr. Chair, I think, I guess we have a correction. It's not in the State Department's bill. You want to add? Okay.
No, Mr. Chair.
Where is it?
We've only got 20 minutes before we vote, so...
It's not in the State Department's finance bill. It is in the finance budget pages and should be carried in association with this bill.
You're talking about, Ms. Manson, clarification here. I believe you're saying that it's in the, this would be part of the revenue that is in the compliance area, correct, of the finance.
That's correct, Mr. Right.
Okay. Representative Vandiver, I'm sorry, you have a follow-up question or not?
No, I'm finished.
Okay. Representative Knobloch.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner or Mr. Manson or whoever wants to ask. I guess, just maybe I missed this, but is this only for licensed contractors, or if you own a building and you hire someone to, put in new windows or something, just as a building owner, do you have to do this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, assuming that the building was your business, in other words, it wasn't your home or something personal, your cabin, you would have to, and you're paying that construction person to put in the new windows, you would have to withhold and remit on the 2%.
Well, I guess, what I'm trying to get down to is, what's the definition of a business? Let's say that my wife and I own a duplex, and we hire someone to... fix some plumbing for $700, so we're over the $600 threshold. Are we responsible for withholding 2% on the $700 plumbing bill that we hire a plumber to go out and fix in our duplex?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, yes, you would. And you would be required to issue a 1099 to that person, too.
Yeah, okay. But not for a personal residence.
Not for a personal residence or a cabin, something that you didn't use in your trade or business.
Okay, but I just wanted to be clear, Mr. Chair.
So it would be a trade or business.
So, I mean, anything besides your home or your cabin, any investment property you own, like a duplex or something, that is a business, and so that would be covered by this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, that would be clear.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Haugen, we saw this last year, but I don't recall what the threshold was. I believe it was lower than $600, but I don't remember. And then also, Minnesota ranks 47th on the Small Business Survival Ranking System. We were 48th. We've taken a big leap. Can you tell me how this helps small businesses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I think I'll have Assistant Commissioner Manson answer that. I can tell you how it works. What it does to business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I can't say that and argue that it's going to help small businesses and their costs just comply with the tax laws. We brought it forward because we see that it is a major issue for when these contractors hire subcontractors that are non-residents. come up here to fix houses on a tornado or something, and there's a lot of non-resident subcontractors up here that do the work. There's no withholding, and then we get a 1099 years later, and they're living down in Texas or Arkansas or wherever. So we brought it forward because we see that it's a compliance issue, and there's some real dollars involved here, and that's why we brought it forward.
I'm sorry, Representative Broad, do you have a follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. I just wonder if we couldn't do some things within the licensing of these contractors versus passing the burden onto the small businesses in the state.
Don't say license and contractor in the same sentence.
I didn't say sub.
Okay, I'm sorry. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really an interesting little part of this puzzle here. But could you tell me the how you decided on July 31st who to start this in the middle of the year rather than a whole year?
Who wants to take it?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Westerberg, we just chose that date as by assuming when a bill would pass and then having time to educate contractors on the new requirement. We thought that hopefully there would be a couple months there, so by August 1st that they would be start withholding on these payments. So.
Okay. Representative Westberg, follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just, to me, it just seems like, you know, starting it in the middle of the year, first of all, I understand, you know, certainly that they keep the records, but there are probably some contractors that, you know, they've paid partially, you know, obviously in the first part of the year that further, you know, mess this thing up. But I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Cranky. Could you talk on this 2% again, back to Representative Knobloch's question. How would that be treated when property is held in trust? The different types of trusts are available and regarding the requirement to withhold the 2%.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I assume that the trust is using the property in their trade or business?
No, as a personal, you know, their families that put land in trust and properties in trust, joint trust, things like that. Would it be the same finding as what you gave Representative Knobloch?
Mr. Chairman, it would be the same finding except that, you know, let's say that you have this house that mom lives in, and she lives in it, and you're going to have, the trust is going to have the house repaired some way, or they're going to put a new roof on. There, the house isn't being used in a trade or business. You don't have to do the 2%. You don't have to issue a 1099. If, on the other hand, the property that's in trust, the trust is renting it out, getting money as rental, and they're in the rental business for this property, then they would be required to give the 1099 if they pay more than $600, and they would be required to, if this passed, would be required to withhold and remit the 2%.
Take it.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, continuing on Representative Knobloch's line, if grandma owns a duplex, she lives in it, she has a problem with the sewer system or something coming in there. Part is rented out, she lives in the other part, and it costs, she would have to get that done anyhow, but it costs $700. Does she have to do this then?
Nothing like
that. Does it have to be done electronically?
Okay. I'm not really sure what the answer to that would be, where half of it is being paid basically for personal, $350, and $350 is being paid for trade or business. I don't know what the answer is, that whether you'd have to issue a 1099 for that or not.
Mr. Chairman, it also was something that had to be done for her to live there, even if there wasn't the unit.
Mr. Chairman, as a Representative Motor, that's my quandary. I don't know if they prorate the $600 for the duplex situation. What if it was a triplex or a fourplex? It would be the same thing. I'm not really sure what the answer is.
Sensing unanimity on that issue.
Well, wait till the next one, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's move on to Article 2. Maybe we'll get the broader agreement on Article 2.
Mr. Chairman, Article 2 is the federal update. Since we last did a federal update, there have been four federal bills, a couple small ones that had a few federal tax provisions, and a couple of fairly substantial ones that were in late of last year. The first one, there was a Military Family Relief Act that had about eight provisions that were basically for the military. They were small provisions that didn't affect a lot of people who weren't in the military, although astronauts could get a break out of this if they died in the course of their duties. These were effective back to, well, some of them were actually effective way back to 1997. If you sold your house and you were in the military and you weren't able to live in that house because you were stationed somewhere away from that house, they were giving you a break so that the periods of time that you were away from the house in active duty didn't count for the 2 out of the 5 year period. That went all the way back to 97. There were a number of them dealing with, for instance, the death benefit if you died in the line of duty. The old death benefit was $6,000. Of that, federally and statewide, you got to exclude $3,000 of it. In this bill, what they did is they upped that to $12,000. Excuse me. And they also said that all $12,000 of it was excluded from taxable income. Those provisions, generally, since we treat most of our military people as non-residents, don't have a big impact on Minnesota. We don't have a large number of people who would be affected by those. However, there was a provision dealing with the National Guard, where they were saying you could get a deduction above the line for your overnight expenses to go to guard training. That would have had an effect on a few people in Minnesota. By and large, there was not a lot of revenue impact to that bill. The next bill was the Medicaid bill. In that bill, there was provisions for health savings accounts, which I think you probably had numbers of discussions about. That was effective for 2004. As of now, we haven't adopted any of those things. Then we move on. There was also one other provision that said that if you're an employer who is going to keep their drug coverage for their retired workers after this has been enacted, the federal government, starting in 2006, will be giving you sort of a grant to keep that coverage for those people. The federal law also said that this amount that you're going to get isn't going to be federal taxable income as it normally would be unless they put in this special provision. So that's the first two. The next two deal, the third one was the Working Family Tax Relief Act. In that one, they expired a number of expiring provisions. The one that applies most, the broadestly, but is actually a small break, is where teachers purchase material for their classrooms. They can take a deduction of up to $250 above the line instead of taking it as an itemized deduction. That went back to 2004, so that was retroactive. There was a deduction for buying a clean fuel vehicle car. That was supposed to phase out in 2004 and 2005. Under this new federal law, they don't phase out. They said that you could still establish an Archer Medical Savings Account. That's a minor provision. The main thing that they did here that has a larger impact, but the impacts don't show up until 2005, is they're going to increase the standard deduction for married couples. The current law is that we're at the standard deduction for a married couple is 175% of what it is for a single person.
Representative Abrams.
What would it cost to conform to federal changes in the increase in the standard deduction for married joint filers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, that is rather costly. In 2006, if we went to 200% instead of 175%, the price tag would be $39 million. For 2007, it goes down to $17,450,000. For 2008, it becomes $15,000. $300,000. It keeps going down because our current law is ramping up to the 200% anyway. Federally, what they did in this bill is they said, we're not going to ramp up any longer. We're going to go right to the 200%.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the February forecast is going to bring. I can think of absolutely no good policy reason not to conform to the standard deduction limit in federal law if we're going to be using federal taxable income as basically our jumping off point. I would hope that if the February forecast is better, that part of the administration's proposal will be to conform to the standard deduction issue. I could think of no greater key-off factor than a taxpayer filling out their forms, having to add back $1,000 of income because we didn't conform to the standard deduction in Minnesota. This is a non-itemizer even. And then, oh, by the way, we go to the marriage penalty, and there's no marriage penalty after they've done that. This is gonna affect, I would suspect, somewhere around 2 million filers. And I would hope, Commissioner, that you can, if I have to, I'll talk to the governor about it, Commissioner, but I do think that this is a pretty big issue. And it's easy, the reason I want to be recognized is because I know what the Democrats would say, but I would hope that you would find a way in which the administration can come forward and fix this one, because there is no good tax policy behind it.
Commissioner, I think I probably have some ideas, but can you give us an indication as to how your agency decided which issues you were going to seek federal conformity on and which ones you opted not to have conformity?
Mr. Chair, it was, I think, simply a matter of trying to do as much as we could to get as many of the provisions in to sort of minimize the additional complexity on the tax return. Obviously, there are other ways we could have cut that, but that was the main. Obviously, we were looking at trying to do as much as we could at the least amount of cost.
All right, let's continue then.
Mr. Chairman,
let's see, where was it?
The other thing that happened in the Working Family Relief Act is they tried to more or less unify what the concepts of qualifying child and dependent. There always were certain quirks that were going on in that area, so that you could in some cases be a qualifying child but not be a dependent and vice versa. So what they did is they changed both of those so that they were basically the same. The biggest thing that they did is, under the old laws for dependency for your children, you almost had to provide more than 50% of the child's support, or else they weren't going to be your dependent. Under this new test, the way that it works is a child will be a dependent as long as they don't provide more than 50% of their own support. Then, for instance, if the mother and the grandmother, they each provide 30% of the support for the child lives with both of them. There, neither one of them provided 50%, so neither one of them theoretically could have claimed the child as a dependent. Under this, they will. One of the two of them will. And then they have tiebreakers who gets to claim the child. First, the parents get to claim it. Then, if two parents claim it, or can claim the child, then the one with the highest income, if they're filing separate returns, gets to claim it. And they have these tie-breaking rules. So that's what they're doing with the concept of dependent child and for qualifying child. That would be, if we don't adopt that, that would be rather messy for us to have the old standard and they have new ones. Last
Mr.
bill...
Mr. Haugen, just a clarification there. So we are looking at total federal conformity in the working family tax relief area?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I can sort of go over where we're not going to, where the governor is not performing to conform, if that's what you'd like.
No, that's fine. We'll step through it.
We're going to muddle all the way through?
The way said, perhaps members, as I said, it's almost noon here, the end of our committee time, so we've sensing that the committee's not quite ready to vote on this bill yet. We're going to hold this over until we'll come back. Members, have the department come back Wednesday. Members, on Wednesday we are going to hear from Growth and Justice and their presentation, and then we will come back to the overview of House File 660. We likely won't vote Wednesday on the bill either, but so the Representative Mueller, you want to move the minutes from the February 16th meeting? Minutes? You want to move the minutes? You're going to move them? Thank you. Any additions, deletions, corrections to the minutes? If not, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, minutes are adopted. Meeting's adjourned, members.